It would take a lot of thought and planning and expertise. To go to all this trouble, you can bet your ass there's a reason, even if it's one that might not make sense to us. Headley had turned his attention back to the box Fleck was holding. How many of those can there be? Not that many, right? You go to every elevator maintenance company, find out if one of these has been stolen. Fleck looked grim.
Mr. Mayor, you remember before we came up here, I said what I had to tell you was worse than what you already knew?
Headley made a face that suggested he'd had a bad burrito.
I think we know what that is now. A paralyzed city.
Well, yeah, that's pretty bad. But what I wanted to tell you was about this box.
Fleck held it up in his hand next to his face, like a Price is Right girl, but without the fake smile.
Anybody can get one of these off eBay for $500.
30. Jerry Burke was slipping on his jacket and getting ready to leave the station at the end of his shift when his desk phone rang. Lois Delgado had left early to look after her sick kid, so he couldn't hand it off to her. Before departing, she'd gotten back to Gunther Willem to find out if he'd learned whether Otto Petrenko might have worked on one or both of the elevators that had killed people in the last 2 days. Burke, checking his phone on the way back into Manhattan, got up to speed about the York Avenue elevator mishap that had claimed the life of some Russian scientist.
I hate coincidences, he'd said. Two elevators drop and we've got an elevator technician beaten to death.
Once they were back at the station, she'd called Willem. He promised to get back to her as soon as he could. Shortly before Delgado left, he phoned in and reported that according to company records, Petrenko had never done work in those two buildings, but the company had in years past. Even so, Delgado had made a point of telling their captain that while there might be no connection whatsoever, she and Burke were investigating the death of an elevator technician. The captain said that if those two elevator incidents were anything more than straightforward accidents, the information hadn't made its way to their precinct yet. Now, on his own, Burke was standing by his desk thinking about what he would pick up from the hot table on his way home when the phone rang. He snatched up the receiver and put it to his ear.
Detective Burke, he said.
Is this Detective Burke?
A woman asked. It never mattered that you gave your name when you answered. People had to make sure.
That's right.
This is Misha Jackson. You were trying to reach me?
Yes, he said, slipping back into his chair, reaching for a notepad and taking a pen in hand. Thanks for returning my call.
I work in the casino and don't get off work till about 4 in the morning, and I turn off all the phones so I can get a decent sleep. When I woke up...
And at this point, she started to cry.
I had calls from my brother and Eileen. I can't believe this. Who would do something like this to Otto?
I'm sorry for your loss, Burke said.
I can't get my head around it. Otto was... He was an okay guy. I don't know why anyone would do this.
That's what we're trying to find out.
Anatoly, my brother, said you'd already talked to him.
Yes, I'm wondering if your story is similar to his.
Misha Jackson made sniffing noises at the other end of the line.
Yeah, I guess. It was weird. I mean, we didn't hear much from Otto. He was always the odd one out of the three of us, you know?
Explain.
Well, he was always more of a loner, more to himself. Me and Anatoly had lots of friends, but Otto was the one who kept to himself. He was kind of a mechanical geek from the get-go. He'd have never gone outside the house if our mother hadn't forced him.
Mechanical geek.
Even as a kid, he always took apart everything to see how it worked. Toaster, TV, you name it. Computers, too. He could just see the inside of a machine in his head, you know what I mean?
Sure. His boss said as much.
I get a Christmas card from him and Eileen every year. But even that, she wrote it and put the stamp on it and walked it down to the corner mailbox. Otto didn't give us much mind. But we were still family, you know? Just because he didn't pay much attention to us didn't mean he didn't give a shit. If something happened to either one of us, he'd be there. 4 years ago, my husband had a heart attack, and it was looking bad there for a while, and when Otto heard about it, he was on the first plane out to see how I was doing.
Sounds like, on balance, a good brother. Another sniff.
Yeah.
Tell me about his recent calls.
Burke heard the woman take a breath.
It was strange. Him calling for no obvious reason. Wasn't my birthday or Christmas. He just calls and asks how we're doing. But here's the part that's strange. He wanted to know what hours I work, and I told him. And next thing you know, he's calling me at the casino. And not from his home phone. A different phone.
Hmm, said Burke.
And on this call, he's all, hey, Misha, you need to watch yourself. Make sure you lock your doors. Make sure you put on the alarm at night. He even wanted to know if I carried a gun. Why the hell would I want to do that? He tells me it's legal to carry a concealed gun in Nevada, that I should think about doing that. And I'm thinking, where is this coming from? And I ask him, and he says it's nothing, but the world's changing. You can't be too careful.
That sounds like what he told your brother. He wanted him to carry a gun, too.
I asked him if he was in trouble, and he said no. But I could tell he was lying. It was in his voice. He was definitely on edge about something.
Did he say whether he was being threatened in any way?
No.
Did he talk about the flyovers?
The who?
An activist group.
I don't remember any talk about that.
It sounds as though your brother was trying to put you on guard. That he believed there was some threat to you that he wasn't willing to share.
Well, no one's threatened me except for a guy who lost $100,000 the other night on blackjack. He wasn't too happy and security had to remove him, but that's work stuff. Happens now and again. But outside the casino, going about my business, I haven't noticed anything out of the ordinary. No one waiting by my car when I finish work, no one watching the house, at least that I've been able to see.
Is that what Otto was suggesting? That there could be someone watching you? Misha Jackson paused.
That reminds me of something he said. I only just thought of it now.
What did he say?
I kind of forgot about it because it seemed so crazy. I thought he had to be joking. He said, just because you don't see them doesn't mean they aren't there. Kind of a variation of the line about being paranoid. It doesn't mean they're not out to get you. That's why I thought it was a joke that he was referring to that, but now that I think about it, maybe he meant it. Why would anyone be watching me and my brother? That makes no sense.
And yet someone did kill Otto.
Can you think of anyone who might have a grudge against your entire family?
Christ, you think we're next?
I don't know anything like that, Ms. Jackson. But Otto was murdered, and clearly he was trying to warn you. There was a long silence at the other end of the line. Ms. Jackson.
I'm gonna get it.
Get what?
That gun.
31. So, how'd your first day go?
Glover Headley raised an eyebrow as he asked Arla the question. He was nursing Estella while Arla was waiting to take her first sip of Cure Royale. They were seated at a table at Gran Morsi, an Italian place a short walk from City Hall.
Yeah, right, wow, she said. It's not every job where the first thing you see is some dead scientist in an elevator.
That's why I wanted to check in on you.
I hope this wasn't too forward, asking you here for a drink. I wanted to get away from the building, see how you are.
That was a pretty traumatic thing to have to deal with.
Yeah, sure, I get that. Look, aside from the decapitation, it was a pretty good start, you know, like, other than that, Mrs. Lincoln, did you enjoy the play?
Glover couldn't help but chuckle.
God, that's awful.
But the way you put it, that made me laugh. When you got back, the rest of the department was there?
Arla nodded.
Everyone was great. I think tomorrow morning I can really hit the ground running.
That's terrific.
But listen, I'm glad we've got a second to talk because I saw something kind of interesting today.
Glover took a swig of his beer.
Oh, yeah? In the office? No, at the building where it happened.
She described how his father had dealt with the boy who'd been in the elevator when the woman was killed.
He was great with that kid. That's a side of the mayor we don't see often enough.
Yeah, that's for sure, Glover said, an edge to his voice. Arla caught the tone.
What?
Glover put his elbows on the table and leaned in. My dad is a guy with many sides. There was a time, from all accounts, when he was a complete jerk, back when he worked for his own father, looking after the buildings he owned. There are stories, and they're not pretty. But once he got out from under his dad's thumb and started out on his own, I think he started to change, become more empathetic, to actually care about people, you know? At least to some degree, and with some people. But there's always been this part of him, a side he tries to keep buried, where he's still that young man who's stuck doing daddy's dirty work, a cold son of a bitch. It comes out every once in a while. Arla smiled.
Like with you sometimes.
Like with me most of the time, he said. It's kind of an open secret. He sighed. There's even a poor Glover hashtag on Twitter where people post times when my father humiliates me.
That's awful.
Yeah, well, I guess it balances out. Considering there's like half a dozen other Twitter accounts devoted to making fun of him. Arla gave him a sly look.
Which one of them is yours?
That made him laugh again. I'll never tell.
The thing is, I get what he's trying to do.
His dad was tough with him, and that turned him into someone with drive and ambition. He figures if he's tough with me, he'll get the same result. He'll turn me into the kind of man he is. He paused.
I don't know that I want to become the kind of man he is.
Sure, Arla said. I get that. We all have to be, you know, our authentic selves.
She rolled her eyes self-deprecatingly. Or some new age bullshit like that. Glover nodded.
God, I can't believe I'm telling you all this.
He ran his hand over his head. Well, look, I don't want to keep you from anything. I wanted to buy you a drink and make sure that you survived. Arla paused a moment before asking,
You want to get something to eat? I mean, we're just sitting here and it's dinner time and all, but
you totally don't have to. You probably have to go help the mayor do something.
I don't.
Great, Arla said, smiling.
And listen, I'll get this because you've been so...
No, that's nuts, he grinned. I can build the city for this one. I'll write it off as employee training.
Well, you strike me as a very good trainer, Arla said.
As soon as she said it, she thought, what the hell was that? You strike me as a very good trainer. Why did she say something like that? As soon as the words left her lips, she realized it sounded like some 50 Shades come on, which it was not. Unless it was. No, it was not. She had to come back with something else.
The whole department, she said, seems very equipped to bring new people up to speed, to train them in the latest data analysis.
Okay, she thought. Not a bad recovery. She couldn't tell from Glover's expression whether he'd interpreted her previous comment as sexual. That was probably a good sign. But then, Glover leaned in even closer.
You know, we have to be very careful these days. I don't want my sitting here with you, having a drink, having dinner, to be seen in any way as inappropriate. You're not under any pressure to stay. We're living in a post-Weinstein world now. Dinner was my idea, remember? She said.
Glover smiled.
It's nice talking to you.
Yeah,
Arla said slowly. Glover sat back in his chair and raised his palms.
You know, about work. It's good talking about all the things that need to get done.
Of course, right, she said.
He turned his head, scanned the room.
If you see a waiter, let me know and I can score us some menus.
So, Arla said, signaling a change in the conversation's direction.
What did your dad want?
Hmm? When we were at the accident and he texted you to come upstairs?
Oh, yeah. We had to walk all the way to the top. He stopped, looking for someone to bring him a menu, and leaned in conspiratorially.
I don't even know if I should tell you about it.
Why? What?
Glover rubbed his chin, trying to decide how much to share with Arla.
You have to promise not to tell anyone.
Arla felt her pulse quicken.
Yeah, sure, of course.
There was this guy from the building department and this other guy from Homeland Security or something.
You're kidding. Why would someone from Homeland be there?
His voice went even quieter.
They think the elevator was sabotaged.
Her mouth dropped open and her voice rose.
Seriously?
Heads turned at a nearby table. Through gritted teeth, he said,
Shh. I can't tell you this if you're going to look like I just told you I'm gay or something.
A pause.
Which I'm not.
Okay,
she whispered.
Anyway, it looks like the accident was deliberate. Yesterday's, too.
His face grew grim, yet he also looked excited to be able to share privileged information.
Looks like by the same person.
Oh, my God. So it's terrorism?
Could be, he said. It would have to be someone very smart to be able to pull it off. Lots of technical know-how required.
Glover smiled, as if in admiration of whoever had done it.
And this is kind of curious, although I haven't mentioned it to my dad because he's been such a prick lately, pardon my French. But people who supported my father lived in both of those buildings.
You think that means anything?
Glover shrugged. Probably not. I mean, there's probably people in every skyscraper in Manhattan who supported him.
A pause.
Hard as that is to believe at times.
So what are they doing about it?
She asked. Last I heard, they're quietly putting out the word to every landlord in the city to check the elevators, not giving the real reason why. They're making up some excuse, maybe to do with the cameras that were installed.
Cameras?
He filled her in about what had been found on top of the elevator cars.
If that's all that it was, it might just be a Peeping Tom thing, but it's way worse than that.
But if it's happened twice, it could happen again. Don't people need to be warned?
Glover shook his head.
They don't want to start a panic. Listen, I'm going to go find us some menus.
He got up from the table in search of a waiter. Arla watched him walk away, thinking,
Oh my God, my mom so needs to know this.
32.
My feet are dead,
Estelle Clement said to her husband Eugene as she sat on the edge of the bed in their hotel room. She had kicked off her shoes and was massaging her right foot with both hands.
What an idiot I was, wearing heels to the show tonight.
I told you,
Eugene said.
I thought we'd be able to get a cab after. I never dreamed we'd have to walk all the way back. We should have gotten one of those Ubers.
I never take those, he said. There's a record where you were, where you went, when you took the trip.
You don't want the world to know we went to a show and came back to the hotel?
She asked.
I just don't like being tracked, he said.
You've been on edge ever since that TV thing, she said.
The mention of TV prompted Clement to pick up the remote. He pointed it at the television and turned it on. He flipped through channels until he found news.
Did we come all the way from Denver so you could watch TV? She asked.
He ignored her. Estelle said,
Fine.
Having massaged her feet enough that she felt she could walk, she strolled over to the window.
There's not much of a view.
You should have booked us on a higher floor.
This was all they had,
Clement snapped. On the screen was a reporter standing out front of a high-rise building. The chyron across the bottom read, Second elevator disaster in 2 days. He had the volume set too low to make out what she was saying. His wife reached across the bed for her purse and dug out her cell phone.
I'm going to text the kids.
Do that.
We've got 2 more days,
she said with what sounded like a hint of resignation in her voice.
What about tomorrow?
Why don't we talk about it at breakfast? He said. I'm trying to watch this.
She hadn't started texting yet. She was glaring at her husband.
Eugene, she said. Look at me.
He sighed, turned, and said,
What?
She asked,
Who was that man?
What man?
The man sitting in the car after the interview, when you were getting the cab, the one you talked to with your back to him.
Clement's face grew concerned.
I'm not sure I'm following you.
He put down his window and he said something to you. You had a conversation.
He was probably telling me to stop leaning on his car, Clement said.
Do you know him? She asked.
Of course not, he said.
Because I think I've seen him before.
What are you talking about?
I only had a quick look at him, but at home, I thought I saw you talking to him once on the street, and I even thought I saw him in the lobby.
I'd never seen him before in my life.
So you did see him? Today you had your back to him when you talked to him.
Clement was briefly flustered.
I didn't see him. I didn't see anybody. I don't know what the hell you're talking about.
Estelle was quiet for a moment before she asked,
Why did we do this trip?
What? It's our anniversary, for Christ's sake.
I was surprised when you proposed it.
He tossed the remote under the bed and rolled his eyes.
Why wouldn't I?
Because it's the first really nice thing you've done in a long time.
This is what I get. I plan a trip, I fly us to New York, and now I've done something wrong. What do you want from me, Estelle?
She considered the question.
Well, for starters, to love me again, if that's not asking too much.
He looked at her, said nothing. She sat back down on the bed.
I know I'm not 21 anymore, that the years take their toll, but I'd like to think you still found me even a little attractive.
Of course I do,
he said without conviction, glancing for half a second back at the television.
The prescription worked, but you still don't seem to want...
I really don't want to have this conversation again, Estelle.
You never want to have this conversation.
Maybe because we don't need to have this conversation.
If you would just talk to...
I don't need to talk to anyone.
Estelle said nothing for several seconds. Then...
It's a myth that it's always women who lose interest.
Clement briefly closed his eyes and sighed.
This has been a very stressful year for me. Getting the organization up and running, getting the word out, dealing with all these baseless accusations, it's taking a toll. Surely to God you can see that. Maybe you need to stop thinking about yourself all the time and try to imagine what I'm going through.
That cut deep. She eyed him scornfully. Her voice was cold and even when she said,
Everything I do is for you.
He waved his hands in the air, let them fall to his sides.
Fine. Okay, you do.
I think the reason we came here has nothing to do with our anniversary.
That's ridiculous, he said.
She got up from the bed, went to the bathroom, and closed the door. When Clement heard her turn the lock, he grabbed the remote. Maybe, he thought, he could catch the rest of that elevator report on a different newscast. 33. Barbara, as was her routine at night before turning off the lights, was sitting cross-legged on her bed, MacBook in her lap. She was jumping from website to website, reading the latest from the New York Times, Politico, The Hill, The Huffington Post, CNN, BuzzFeed. She'd taken some more painkillers for her elbow, which still hurt like hell. Despite Chris Valens's plea, she had not sought medical attention. She fell. No big deal. People fell all the time. And her elbow still worked. She knew this for a fact because she had used her right arm to empty a bottle of Chardonnay into a wine glass when she'd come home. She'd had a hard time getting Chris Valens out of her head the rest of the day. She was feeling things for him she did not want to feel. Get over it, she told herself. Barbara had made some calls when she returned home. She wanted to reach family members of the others who had died in Monday's elevator crash and ask if any spooky officials in black SUVs had come to see them too, to tell them to keep their questions to themselves, to not speak to the media. She figured that was a better place to start since she was going to run into more problems, especially considering she did not speak Russian, trying to find relatives of the woman who died in today's elevator incident. She had no luck getting any of Sherry D'Agostino's relatives to call back. Ditto for the family of Barton Fieldgate. But she did get through to Stuart Bland's mother. Stuart, as it turned out, had still lived at home.
I told him to leave that lady alone, she said tearfully once Barbara had identified herself. He went to her house and nearly got in trouble. He wouldn't have been in that elevator if he'd listened to me.
It took several more questions for Barbara to get the full picture, that Stuart was trying to get a producer to look at a script he had written. That was what had taken him to the Lansing Tower.
At first, they thought he had something to do with it, Bland's mother said, because he was using a phony ID for FedEx, so that made them suspicious. But he couldn't have had anything to do with it. That's just crazy. He could barely get his bicycle chain back on. I think I convinced them. But I shouldn't even be telling you this.
Why?
The man said.
What man?
The man who came to see me from the government.
Did he say which department?
He didn't say, but I could tell.
What was his name?
I'm not sure he told me. He didn't leave a card. I have to go.
And she hung up. Barbara wrote a piece for Manhattan Today, but it didn't take long, and she wasn't very happy with it. Recounting her conversations with Bland's mother and Paula's parents, she asked her readers, "Who is this mystery man?" Why would someone want the families of the victims to keep a low profile while the elevator accident was being investigated? Why would they be pressured not to ask questions? Barbara did not speculate in her piece. She did not mention the FBI or CIA or Homeland Security. She didn't have anything solid enough to do that. And Valens hadn't been any help when she'd asked him about it. If he knew anything, he wasn't saying. And he never did answer the bald question, the bastard. Okay, so maybe that was too personal. Just as well she'd resisted the urge to run her hand over his head. Looking again at the story she posted, she fretted at how light it was on facts. But maybe someone who did know something would read it and get in touch. That was often how it worked. A story that was incomplete could produce more leads than a story that didn't run at all. It had produced a few responses already, not that they were in any way useful. Just comments from, as Barbara's father once referred to those who call into radio talk shows, a cavalcade of nincompoops. There was Spicy Dragon, who said, "Anybody that old who still lives with his mommy deserves to die." And there were these words of wisdom from Deep State Harry. "We are all being watched. There are black vans everywhere." Barbara was about to move on from the Manhattan Today website when one other comment caught her eye. "Hope you are feeling better." It was from Going Down. Barbara felt, along with the persistent dull pain in her elbow, a chill run down her spine. "Hope you are feeling better." Barbara thought back to when Chris Valens had tackled her in the middle of the street. All this time, she'd thought he was the only one keeping an eye on her. Was it possible someone else was, too? Whoever this going-down person was, had he, or she, seen that van nearly hit her? When she screamed in pain about her elbow, had this person heard her? Barbara tried to think back to the scene. There was the old lady who got her phone, that postal worker, the woman with the shopping cart. Was it one of them? Going down had been the one in a response to her last article to express condolences about Paula Chatsworth. Okay. That's what going down is referring to. Not my fault today. Barbara touched her hand to her chest. Her heart had briefly raced at the thought that she was being watched. She was getting paranoid. Thinking about mysterious men in black SUVs had prompted her mind to go places it shouldn't.
Chill out, girl,
she said under her breath. That was when she moved off the Manhattan Today site and started surfing all the other news outlets. The so-called experts said screens should be avoided an hour before bedtime. Artificial light from phones and tablets and laptops messed up sleeping patterns, they argued. Bullshit, Barbara thought. This was what she did every night. Even if she had someone over, if some man wanted to roll over and go to sleep after a fuck, that was fine with her, but don't expect her to ignore what was going on in the world. Frankly, this was one of the reasons why she didn't like having men spend the night. Not only did they want you to put the laptop away, they expected you to make them breakfast. Fuck that. Barbara closed the laptop, killed the lights, and put her head on the pillow. She was about to close her eyes when she noticed her phone, sitting screen side up on the covers next to her, light up with a text. Barbara glanced over. It was Arla. There really hadn't been a moment all day when Arla wasn't in her thoughts. Even when Barbara had been with the Chatsworths or talking to Stuart Bland's mother, Arla was on her mind. Barbara had been unable to stop thinking about Arla's new job and what had motivated her to go after it. Had she done it to drive her mother nuts? Or was it really a position she wanted that she believed would challenge her? Barbara, in one moment, would think her reaction to Arla's news at breakfast had been perfectly justified, and in the next, she would feel she'd totally blown it. She replayed the conversation in her head countless times. I should have said, and I shouldn't have said. Barbara picked up the phone and read the message. You up? Barbara typed, yes, in return. Is it too late to call? Barbara quickly tapped, no. She only had to wait 10 seconds for the phone to ring with its distinctive typing chime. Hey, Barbara said.
Hey,
Arla said.
I know it's late and all, but... No, it's okay. I'm still up.
Everything all right?
Yeah, sure. Things are good.
Barbara hesitated before asking, how was the first day?
It was interesting.
That doesn't sound good.
No, I mean, it really was interesting. I hadn't even started, and I ended up going to that second elevator accident.
Arla filled her in.
God,
Barbara said.
You saw what happened?
Yeah.
You okay?
I guess.
Although I'm sure I'll have nightmares or something. When I saw it, I thought, don't be a wuss, don't freak out. Believe me, it wasn't easy.
Barbara hesitated before asking,
did you meet him?
You mean the mayor?
Yes.
No.
And Glover didn't introduce me either. I'm too low level.
Glover, you met his son.
Yeah, he oversees the department that hired me, so he showed me around because everyone else was off at a seminar.
Glover's your boss?
I'll have several. There's my immediate supervisor, then Glover, and then, I guess, well, ultimately we're all working for the mayor, right?
Arla paused.
Look, Mom, about this morning. Yeah, it's okay. I said some things, and I'm sorry.
I've been working through a lot of stuff. I'm trying to sort them out. I didn't take this job to be all in your face. I mean, maybe a little, but this is something I could...
It's okay, Barbara said again, her voice soft, reflective.
It's your life. The mayor's hard to get a handle on. I saw him do something really nice today when no one was watching with this kid who'd been in the elevator where this woman got killed. But with Glover, for example, he's a shit. Well, he was telling me tonight, we grabbed a bite, about how complicated his relationship with his father is. But listen, that's not why I called. It's kind of tricky to talk about, and I probably shouldn't say anything, but Glover said, getting this close to the mayor's son, you need to be careful about that. What?
Barbara thought a moment before offering a reason.
If they find out who your mother is, they'll question your motives. I told you this job has nothing to do with you. I'm just saying, watch your step with him. I don't need your advice, Arla said, an edge in her voice. I'm just trying to... You know what? Arla said. You're right. I was going to tell you something, but now I realize that's not a good idea. Tell me what?
Arla didn't answer.
Arla?
It took Barbara a moment to realize her daughter had ended the call.
Shit,
she said, and tossed the phone onto the floor. She flopped back on the bed, her head crushing the pillow. A minute later, she turned out her light and stared at the ceiling until dawn. 34. I'm going to say something to him, the boy says.
I am. I don't care if he gets mad.
His mother shakes her head angrily.
No, you're not.
I've known him longer than you have. There's no talking to him.
He's so mean. You should.
But the boy stops himself. What he wants to tell his mother is that she should stand up for herself. That she shouldn't take any more shit from this man. But he can't bring himself to do that, because he knows that everything she does for him. She does not deserve his scorn or criticism, and yet,
if something isn't done, he says, and it is at this point that his voice starts to break, you could, you know, don't be silly, she says, nothing is going to happen to me. She smiles, I'm made of tough stuff, don't you worry about me. But last night, the boy says, you said your heart felt like... Enough, she says sternly. Go do your homework.
Wednesday. 35. I will never come to this hotel again. Elliot Cantor pressed the down button for what had to be the 10th time. No, not pressed. He stabbed the button. He was angry at the button. Elliot wanted to kick this button's ass. He wanted to put this button in a blender and slice and dice it to death. Elliot loathed this elevator. This one and the one next to it. A 30-story hotel with a dozen or more rooms per floor needed more than two elevators. Both of them were always busy.
I don't believe this, Elliot said.
His partner, Leonard Falks, said,
It's okay, it'll get here eventually. I've got my doubts, Elliot said.
Elliot and Leonard, both 31 years old and both from Toronto, were on a week-long trip to New York. They'd both been here before on business in their respective jobs. Elliot was a financial advisor and Leonard a freelance book editor, but they had never visited together. A friend had recommended to Elliot that they stay at the Claxton 49.
one of four Manhattan hotels owned and managed by the small Claxton chain. Elliot did the booking online after reading good things on TripAdvisor. Well, his review was not going to be like the others. He'd already been writing it in his head. It was going to read something like this. This 30-story hotel may be clean and centrally located, and the staff are nice enough, but do not go here unless you love to wait for 5 fucking hours for the elevator to arrive. This had been their experience since day one. They were on the 15th floor, the building's midpoint. Had they been given a room on a lower floor, they would have used the stairs. And even now, Elliot was considering them. Descending was a lot easier than ascending. Not that the two of them weren't in good shape, but sometimes, after 7 or 8 hours of walking all over Manhattan, the last thing you wanted to face when you got back to the hotel was a grueling climb. Elliot was watching the numbered lights to see where the two elevators were. One was at the 5th floor and moving up. The other was on the 20th floor and moving down. And the time the elevators were spending on each number was evidence that many guests were boarding and exiting. The ascending elevator stopped at 7, then 9, then 12. Elliot was hopeful that last person to disembark would be at 15, meaning they could step right on and go down. But the descending elevator was now on the move, heading toward them. Only 2 floors away now.
"Why don't you press it again?" Leonard said.
Elliot gave him a look, knowing he was being needled, but that didn't stop him from doing exactly what Leonard asked. He hit the button. He attacked the button. The descending elevator stopped 1 floor above them.
"This has to be it," Leonard said, striking an optimistic note, hoping his partner would calm down.
The elevator moved. They heard it whiz past in the shaft. It did not stop for them. The light flashed at 14, 12, 9. It was heading straight to the lobby. Elliot, in a sign of defeat, slowly leaned his head forward and rested it on the wall above the buttons. The elevator coming up went right past 15 and stopped at 22. Leonard watched, wondering if it would keep on going up or start coming back down. Now, it was coming down. "Elliot," he said cautiously. Elliot raised his head slowly, then looked up at the numbers. The second elevator was 3, 2, 1 floor away. They did not hear the sound of something whooshing past. The elevator sounded as though it was coming to a stop. And then the doors opened.
"Sweet Jesus, it's a miracle," said Elliot.
That was the good news. The bad news was that the car was nearly full. Jammed into the back were an elderly couple who were clearly at the end of their stay, each one clutching the handle of a wheeled carry-on bag. Also on board were a 40-ish woman in a pink tracksuit and 2 teenage girls, also in matching tracksuits and running shoes. Elliot didn't have to be Sherlock Holmes to figure out these were the woman's daughters. At least there was still just enough room for him and Leonard to get on without having to scrunch shoulders. No one said anything as they boarded, but there seemed a collective sense of despair in the car. The others had been waiting an eternity as well for this ride to street level. Leonard went to press the L for lobby, but it was already lit. The car began to descend, and then stopped. They had gone 1 entire floor. One of the teenage girls said,
"Of course."
The doors parted to reveal a young couple, and Elliot wanted to scream, a stroller with a small child in it.
Said Elliot. "I don't think so. We're pretty full here."
"No, we can do it," the father said, pushing in the stroller first, bumping the tiny rubber wheels over the metal edge. Everyone else in the elevator had to back up. Once the father had the stroller in, he positioned it sideways so as to make space for the mother. She stepped in and waited for the doors to close.
"I always wanted to feel like a sardine,"
Leonard whispered into his partner's ear. Someone had to say it, Elliot thought. The elevator descended one more floor and then stopped again. A groan slipped through the lips of everyone in the elevator, with the exception of the couple who had just entered, and their child, of course, who was oblivious to everyone else's aggravation.
Seriously, this is too much, said the elderly man to his wife.
The way this is going, we'll miss our flight, she said softly. If there's traffic, we'll never get to LaGuardia in time.
The doors parted. Everyone thought, Jesus Christ, no! Before them stood a man in his early 20s, about 5'10", and easily 300 pounds. He was decked out in a pair of shorts and a pair of oversized, unlaced sneakers and an I Love New York sleeveless shirt where love was a heart symbol. The thick laces trailed behind him like bright orange worms.
I really think you're gonna have to wait for the next one, Elliot said.
Fuck that, he said. I've been standing here 10 minutes. He started to board, forcing his body into the mass of human flesh. The small boy in the stroller looked up wide-eyed at this towering mass of person hovering over him. The large man continued to force everyone to squeeze back even farther. The older woman said,
I don't think I can breathe.
Although that might have had less to do with being compressed and more to do with the newest passenger's sleeveless shirt. He was, not to put too fine a point on it, aromatic. Everyone was jammed in so tightly that the man did not even try to turn around. He faced the back wall of the elevator and said to one of the teenage girls who was closest to the panel of buttons, Can you hit lobby?
It already is, she said.
Her sister said, Hit the close button.
The what?
She pointed to the button with the two triangular symbols pointing at each other. Her sister hit the button. The doors started to close, then bounced back. The newest passenger's butt was in the way. It was the girl's mother's turn to speak up.
Honestly, I think you're going to have to take the next.
But rather than get off, the man pushed in even farther, his belly hovering over the head of the child in the stroller. The girl pushed the button again. The doors once again attempted to close, and this time they made it.
Shit,
said one of the girls, looking down. The door had closed on a trailing orange shoelace from one of the big man's unlaced sneakers. As the car started to move downward, the slack went out of the lace. In less than a second, the shoe it was attached to was dragged suddenly to the door, which pitched the large man forward. As his meaty leg was yanked upward, the top half of his body toppled. Like a great oak falling in the forest, he went straight to the floor, narrowly missing the child, but hitting the arms of the stroller, pitching the boy upward like he was on a teeter-totter and someone had dropped a boulder at the other end. Everyone screamed. The teenage girl's screams came out more like shrieks. No sooner had the big man hit the floor than he started to lift up as his one leg headed toward the top of the door. But then the shoe was ripped from his foot. He came crashing down again. The shoe sailed up to the center of the door until the lace snapped and it dropped back down.
Benji!
The mother screamed, reaching over the man to see that her child was okay.
Fucking hell!
Elliot shouted. Somehow, impossibly, everyone had pushed back to allow room for the fallen man. The girls were literally perched on Leonard's feet. The child's father's arms were spread wide against the wall of the car. The toddler was crying. The stroller was a write-off. And then the doors opened. They had reached the lobby. Half a dozen people waiting to board recoiled in horror at the sight of the collapsed man. The girls managed to step around him, quickly followed by their mother. Once out, they stopped and turned to offer help. The big man slowly got up off the floor. Elliot actually extended a hand to help him. You okay? He asked. The man nodded, then spotted his shoe, minus half a lace, on the floor of the car. Leonard grabbed it and handed it over.
Please,
said the older woman, still at the back of the car. Let us out! We have to catch a plane! She and her husband navigated their way around the others, but as soon as they exited the elevator, they were faced with a throng of people who'd been waiting for it.
Look what you did,
said the small child's mother, who now had the toddler in her arms and was pointing to the mangled stroller.
Sorry,
he said. You should never have gotten on, the father said. And Christ, maybe this'll teach you to tie up your shoes. I said I was sorry. Anyway, it's the hotel's fault. The door grabbed my lace. The parents shook their heads as they hauled the busted stroller off the elevator.
You sure you're okay?
Leonard asked. The big man nodded slowly.
I might have twisted my ankle, he said, looking down at his socked foot. But I guess I'm all right.
Okay, he said. Then looked at Elliot and gave him a shrug that said, I guess we're done here. As the two headed through the lobby, Elliot said, I thought that guy was going to lose his leg or something.
I want my granola parfait from Le Pain Quotidien, Leonard said, and then we're going to see if we can move to another hotel.
Elliot smiled. So now you're the one who's fed up. As they came out of the hotel, Leonard said,
that guy could have crushed us to death.
So what? You're looking for a hotel that bans fatties? That sounds very un-PC.
They took a moment to get their bearings as they stood on the sidewalk.
A yellow Prius cab was working its way down the street.
Leonard pointed east.
It's that way. No, Elliot said, grabbing his arm. I'm pretty sure Le Pen's that way.
The cab was 60 feet away.
Wait, Leonard said, looking one way and then the other. I hate to admit this, but I think you're right.
The cab passed by the hotel doors.
Okay, then, let's...
And that was when the bomb in the Prius exploded. 36. 3 minutes after the taxi explosion on East 49th Street, 8 people were huddled out in front of the 3 elevators in the lobby of the 20-story Gormley building on 7th Avenue between 16th and 17th Streets. A man and a woman who were closest to the closed doors were both gazing at their phones. The woman was reading the New York Times, and the man was scanning information from an app that tracked the stock market. He shook his head slowly, not liking what he was seeing. Of the 6 people behind them, most were on phones. Others sipped expensive lattes from Starbucks cups. Every few seconds, someone would glance upward to see what floor the car was currently on. It had been up on the 18th floor, but was heading their way. About 10 seconds later, the doors parted. The man and woman who'd been standing closest each took a step forward without looking up from their phones and went down. There was no car. Odds were they might have survived. It was not as though they stepped into the shaft 20 floors up. They plunged, but only as far as the basement. There was only one floor below the lobby level. There was no parking garage beneath the Gormley building, so the elevator did not go any great distance below the street. The shaft, however, did extend slightly farther than the basement level into a pit that accommodated elevator servicing. It was into this pit that the 2 people fell. As they pitched forward through the open doorway, screams erupted from those directly behind them. No one else blindly followed them into the shaft. Once the cries of, "Oh my God," and "Holy shit," and "Fuck," subsided, a casually dressed man, with buds in his ears, leaned into the opening and looked down. The 2 people were rag dolls, their arms and legs a twisted mess. The floor of the shaft was dirty, and the grimy cement walls were lined with cables and tracks. The fallen man was struggling to move one of his arms. The woman could be heard moaning. They're alive, said the earbuds guy, glancing back at the others as he yanked on the wires that led up to his head. Call 911! Someone with a phone in hand was already punching in the 3 numbers. The man with the earbuds leaned back into the shaft and shouted down to the 2 injured people, Help's coming, hang in there! A breathless, uniformed security guard arrived, pushing his way through the onlookers until he got to the opening. What's going on? What's happened? The earbud guy said. Door open, no car, they went straight in. The security guard's eyes went wide. Basement, he said. We can get closer to them if we open the elevator doors in the... And that was when they heard a mechanical noise. They both looked up. What they saw was the bottom of the elevator car, which had been all this time sitting at the second floor. It was now slowly moving in a downward direction. Fuck me, said the security guard, backing out of the shaft and pulling the other man with him. The car's descent was bafflingly and maddeningly slow. The base of the car had now moved below the top of the opening to the shaft. The inner doors of the elevator car were closed. While there was still a chance to see the bottom, the earbud guy noticed that the fallen man had actually managed to get to his knees. He was leaning over the woman, checking on her. As the car descended halfway past the opening, the security guard said, "Shit!" He reached over and hit the up button, hoping that would halt the elevator's progress, or at least make it come to a stop at the lobby level. That way, rescue crews would still be able to reach the injured by way of the basement elevator door. All the security guard had to do was grab the special elevator key. All elevators had a small, peephole-sized opening in the door into which the key could be inserted. Once turned, it would open the doors. It seemed like a plan. Briefly, the elevator car maintained its slow descent. It did not stop at the lobby level. It continued slowly on its inexorable downward path. The injured man, no longer visible, could be heard shouting, "Make it stop! Stop the fucking thing!" Frantically, the security guard, unable to think of anything else to do, kept jabbing at the button. "Come on! Stop, you son of a bitch!" The top of the elevator car now dropped below the level of the lobby floor. The screams from the man in the pit grew more intense and were joined by the woman. A bone-chilling, two-person chorus of death. The elevator car, like some cunning animal moving in on its injured prey, maintained its slow descent until it finally came to a stop. The screaming ceased. 37. Eugene Clement was reading a print edition of the New York Times while, across the table from him in the hotel restaurant, his wife was looking at stories on a tablet. On the plate before her was her unfinished breakfast, some scraps of scrambled eggs, 1.5 slices of toast, a rasher of bacon. They'd exchanged only a few words since the night before, when Estelle had started asking him about that man he'd been talking to, then tried to move on to the subject of their sex life, which he had no interest in discussing. He'd been partly honest with her when he'd used stress as an excuse. He had been under a considerable mental strain lately. But the real truth was, he had lost interest. Not in sex. Just in sex with Estelle. He'd found ways, back in their hometown and when he traveled the country without her on business, to meet his needs, discreetly. What worried him as he sat here at breakfast had nothing to do with coming up with excuses for why Estelle didn't get his motor running the way she once did. What had him worried was her suspicion that their trip to New York had nothing to do with their anniversary. Which was, of course, correct. He'd been having to enjoy the flyover's activities from afar. It just wasn't very satisfying, watching a bombing in Seattle when you were several hundred miles away. But he wanted to have a front row seat to see how the New York coastal elites reacted when the rubes struck back. Clement believed he had been successful, up to now, in keeping his wife from thinking that the flyovers would ever resort to violence. She appeared persuaded that the criticisms of the flyovers were unfounded. But then, she started asking about the man he'd spoken to briefly. Said she had seen him on more than one occasion. Clearly, Clement and Bucky had to be more careful moving forward. Eugene looked over his newspaper to find his coffee, noticed the food still on his wife's plate, and asked,
"You didn't like your breakfast?"
"It was fine,"
Estelle said, not looking away from the tablet.
"I liked mine," he said. "Not that you asked."
She looked up from the tablet.
"What?"
"Nothing," he said.
Estelle said,
"Maybe you need to let someone else lead the charge."
Clement blinked.
"I'm sorry, what?" "You say you're stressed out," she said. "So let someone else do it. Let someone else speak for the flyovers."
"The work's not done," he said. "I have much to do."
"And when will it be done?" she asked. "Tell me, what is it exactly that you're hoping to achieve? What is it you want?"
This was not like her, challenging him on his mission.
"Awareness, Estelle," he said. "I want to raise awareness."
She sighed. "Like with that godforsaken occupation?" she asked loudly enough to be heard beyond their table.
Clement glanced around quickly to see whether any of their fellow diners had noticed, then leaned over the table and glared at her.
"For God's sake, keep your voice down," he whispered. "And we achieved a lot with that."
Estelle shook her head sadly. "A bunch of grown men having a sit-in in a national park looking like fools. 10 days you were there. It was ridiculous. God knows how long it would have gone on if one of your brilliant partners in crime hadn't tried to sneak out to get Kentucky Fried Chicken and got himself nabbed by the FBI.
Clement leaned back in his chair.
"What's gotten into you lately?"
"Certainly not you," she said icily.
He felt his cheeks go hot.
"You don't win a war with a single battle," he told her. "What we achieved with the occupation may not be evident for some time. These things are cumulative."
She kept her voice to a whisper this time, but her anger was evident.
"Who are you at war with, Eugene? Tell me. The other people in this restaurant? Our waiter? The people at the front desk? Are you at war with them?"
Eugene breathed in slowly. Estelle had never been able to see the big picture.
"A revolution takes time,"
he said. "A revolution," she said dismissively. "You're Paul Revere, is that it?"
"Don't mock me."
"And all these people who follow you, your acolytes, half of them are out of their minds, you know. They're lunatics, blowing up coffee shops. The things you write, the things you say, they get people riled up." She paused. "I know you'd never want them to do those things, but you have to know you have an influence."
Clement took a moment to compose himself. Slowly, he said,
"I am here, right now, in this city, to celebrate our anniversary. I do not want to talk about my work. I do not want to talk about us. So get out your goddamn guidebook and pick some goddamn thing for us to do today, while I go take a goddamn piss."
Estelle's jaw dropped. He threw his napkin onto the table and pushed back his chair. As he walked away, he took out his phone, opened an app, and scanned the latest headlines. There were two breaking stories. Details were sketchy, but there had been another elevator accident. 2 people were believed dead. And on West 49th Street, a taxi had exploded, killing 2 on the street and the driver. Clement slipped the phone back into his jacket and continued to the men's washroom, which was down a short hallway off the lobby. He pushed open the door and walked in slowly. The room appeared, at first, to be empty. He stood briefly in front of the mirror, ostensibly checking his appearance, running his hand over his thinning gray hair. He turned and took a step toward a row of urinals, glancing over his shoulder at the 3 stalls. Two of the doors hung open, but the third was closed. In the gap at the bottom could be seen two shoes. Eugene chose the middle urinal and unzipped. While he stood there, he cleared his throat. Not once, but three distinctive times. From behind the closed stall, a voice Clement recognized as Bucky's said,
"You up to speed?"
"Yes," Clement said.
"It's been quite a morning for the good folks of New York."
"Yeah," Bucky said from inside the stall.
"Any problems?"
"No." Bucky paused, then said, "The cab was a Prius."
"Nice touch,"
Clement said, giving his dick a shake.
"I set it to go off 60 seconds after I got out. Any longer than that, and another passenger might have noticed it in the back."
"Where exactly did it go off?"
"Out front of the Claxton Hotel."
"Nice that it wasn't this one,"
Clement said. Sarcastically, he added,
"I would hate for anything to put a damper on our anniversary weekend."
He paused, then said,
"Speaking of which, you need to be more careful. My wife's noticed you."
"Shit. What'd you say?"
"I said I didn't know what she was talking about."
Clement zipped up.
"At least Estelle isn't going to find us talking in here."
He went back over to the row of sinks, where he washed his hands slowly and methodically. The door opened, and another man walked in. Clement said,
"Morning,"
just loud enough to send a signal to Bucky that their conversation was over. He held his hands under the dryer, but they were still damp when he returned to the hotel dining room. When he went back to the table, Estelle was not there. He scanned the room for her before sitting down. She'd gone back to their room, he figured. She was still angry with him. Fuck it, he thought. I'm going to have another cup of coffee. He spotted the waiter and waved a hand in the air. But then Estelle appeared and sat back down in her seat. She had several flyers in her hand advertising various city attractions.
"Where were you?"
he asked. "Just sorting out what I'm going to do today," she said. "I got tired of hunting through the guidebook. I got these by the front desk." She fanned them out on the table like playing cards, saw one she liked, and picked it up. "The Guggenheim," she said. Clement nodded.
"Sure, we can do that."
Estelle shook her head.
"That's what I'm doing."
She gathered up the other flyers and tossed them to his side of the table. "I'm sure you'll find something just as interesting." 38. Barbara saw a tweet about the exploding taxi on East 49th Street. She went to the link, but there wasn't much more detail there than there had been on the Twitter feed. She was in her kitchen nook, the laptop on her table, sipping on cold coffee, and had been thinking maybe she should get dressed, wishing she had an apartment as nice as Chris Valens's, when she saw the news.
"God,"
she said, reading about the taxi. Another ISIS-inspired nutcase, she figured. Once or twice a year, it seemed, New York had to endure some numbnut would-be terrorist acting alone who had put together some half-assed bomb and then tried to detonate it in Penn Station or the Port Authority or Times Square. Sometimes these assholes did real damage, and other times the things went off before they could even get them out of their apartment. The ones that often created the most mayhem didn't have to build a bomb at all. They just got behind the wheel of a truck and ran people down. These days, anytime anything bad happened, the first thought was, is it terrorism? But what happened on 49th Street might turn out not to be a bombing. Maybe a gas main under the street blew up as the taxi was driving over it. It was possible the cab blew up for reasons unrelated to a bomb. The incident had only happened in the last half hour, and not much was known. Barbara briefly considered turning on the TV, then decided she'd check later. She reread the column she had posted late the previous day. There were a few more comments, none remotely helpful. She was going to try again today to get some kind of statement from any governmental body that would talk to her. Homeland, FBI, the NYPD, somebody. She'd call animal control if she thought anyone there had a clue. Why, she wanted to ask them, had at least two families connected to these elevator deaths been asked to keep their mouths shut? Barbara looked through her own contacts in her phone, making a note of those who might be helpful, then went online looking for other possible leads. She made a list of the people she wanted to reach. She had a